Welcome to the Do Good to Lead Well podcast. If you're passionate about mastering self-leadership, then you're in the right place. I have always been curious about and fascinated by the pursuit of leadership excellence. This is why I pursued my PhD in psychology with a specialization in business, and I've continued to dedicate my career to understanding the science and practice of positive leadership. My name is Craig Dowden. I'm a best-selling author, award-winning keynote speaker, executive coach, and member of the Forbes Coaches Council. Each week, I'll bring you world-class content on the science and practice of positive leadership. Through my conversations with best-selling authors, TED speakers, and top CEOs, you'll be able to leverage their insights and experience so you can maximize your potential and be the leader the world needs you to be. Hello, everyone, and welcome to another edition of the Do Good to Lead Well webinar and podcast series. My name is Craig Dowden. I'm the host of this podcast. Absolutely thrilled to have you here today to join us. Really excited about digging into this conversation. For those of you who have joined for the first time, very warm welcome. Do Good to Lead Well, because of your ongoing support and feedback, is rated in the top 2% of podcasts globally. So that could have never happened without your support. So thank you so, so very much. And I am absolutely thrilled. Like, on so many levels, this is for me a delight, for not just to speak with Anil, also just because of the role. He's Canada's chief statistician and a return guest to the program. So I'm very excited to dig in. Before we get to that, I do want to provide a bio, which I cannot do justice. Anil is an experienced senior public official. He's worked with Statistics Canada for over 25 years, leading significant programs and transformations. He was appointed Chief Statistician of Canada in September 2016. He has also served in policy and regulatory roles in the Government of Canada, at Natural Resources Canada, as well as Health Canada. He has led substantial international initiatives, working with the United Nations and the OECD, and received numerous prestigious awards for leadership. He serves on a number of boards, very active in the community and supporting community events and social causes. He received a Bachelor of Science from the University of Alberta, subsequent studies in computer science, holds a graduate certificate in public sector management and governments from the University of Ottawa and the Government of Canada's Advanced Leadership Development Program. And that's just to kind of get us started. So, Anil, a very warm welcome to the conversation today.
Thank you, Craig. Such a pleasure, as always, to be with you. Thank you for this opportunity.
For everybody who's live, the special bonus, you have the chance to ask Anil. He's kindly agreed to take any questions that you wish. So please chime in. And just to begin this conversation, as Canada's chief statistician, you've had the opportunity, just watching your travels on LinkedIn, taking a part in different international statistical conferences and such amazing conversations. What do you find are the key data points that different countries and your counterparts are paying attention to at this time?
Well, it is a really privileged perch, you know, being able to see in an objective way, you know, what's going on both in Canada and internationally. Interestingly enough, there are so many things that are not that different. Getting out of the post-pandemic situation, obviously there's an economic context that I think most developed countries are facing. We're starting to see that kind of growth. We're seeing inflation now. We're seeing public policy responses, and most of these countries trying to figure out, how do we get back to a position where affordability and everybody can kind of participate in the economy is really important. The other trend that I think most countries are seeing is climate change and the impacts of that on people's health. And I mean, you could just see what's going on in Canada, right? What's the impact on our economies? Of course, every country has its own kind of sources for generating wealth. And so for countries like Canada, which have a real investment in natural resources and some of the more carbon intensive industries, of course, it's a bigger challenge. And then you see this competition as well. So those are, you know, environmental / economic and social concerns. You see misinformation and disinformation. You see trust in institutions, and you see even social cohesion and inclusion as being the big themes that I think most countries are grappling with. And as you can see, most of those are still very relevant in Canada as well. It's degrees of intensity and our respective economies and some of our social teams. Of course, Canada is a country that is so dependent upon immigration, right? And so our diversity presents both real opportunities as a country, but also some real challenges. 96% of our growth comes from immigration. And that immigration is primarily from racialized population. So we're trying to contend with a demographic of aging. We're trying to contend with skills. We're trying to, you know, on the one hand, sort of use demography and immigration as a strength. And then on the other hand, we're trying to contend with some of the issues like housing and skills mismatch and so on, and, you know, rural-urban divide. So those are unique issues in Canada. But as you can see, that statistical perch shows there are some real commonalities, but there's some stark differences as well as a nation.
Well, and it's so interesting. Yes. And thank you. And got some positive comments already on that point. And what I really appreciate, it's interesting in my own world, in the perch that I have, also those common challenges, if you will, like, again, it's very interesting that there are certain things that transcend no matter what sector you're in, what industry you're in, no matter where you are. Yes, there are some pieces that are unique to your space or more relevant, as you talked about. I love how you frame that. And then at the same time, there's kind of this, some human challenges, if you will, like things we're all going through. So that's really cool to hear. Already have got questions, and I'm not surprised. And I love these questions already. You touched on a little bit. Kevin's gonna go a little further and say, love that you talked about misinformation. Any thoughts around how Statistics Canada or other agencies are trying to ensure that the highest quality data get in front of people?
Yeah. I mean, it's hard to believe just a few years ago when, you know, this whole notion of alternative facts, and I thought, really? Like, that's not going to go anywhere. But here we are. So this is real. So you see technology playing a huge part in essentially taking data that are well-researched and come from reputable organizations and the alternative, and essentially in many cases, giving it the same weight. And then exacerbated by the fact that there are filter bubbles and there are communities that have emerged where people vigorously defend their right to flat earth or, you know, or whatever have you. And then all of a sudden more and more misinformation sort of gets bad. And before you know it, I always see the plural of anecdote is not statistic. Many times people will repeat the same misinformation, and before you know it, it becomes gospel. And our brains are wired to look at the sensational a lot more and propagate it than, you know, sometimes boring facts, if you know what I mean. So here we are, right? So you see people kind of really protecting their rights in some sense to what we know for a fact is not well-grounded. That then yields distrust in people and distrust in institutions and the media and politicians and so on. It is a reality. And so, I mean, we just hosted with the Institute of International Statistical Institute the 64th World Congress in Ottawa. It's the first time in 60 years that this Congress came back to Ottawa. Some, you know, 1,800 people, now we're talking mathematicians, statisticians, data scientists, came to Ottawa to discuss over 500 different sessions of different, and misinformation, disinformation was very prominent. So I know this is a real issue for those that produce high quality, timely, granular, integrated stats and insights. It's a real challenge. How do you get things that are well researched, that have that kind of quality baked into it, to get that weight, if you like, in people's decision making? So it's not an easy challenge, but certainly I think a number of organizations are seized with this particular issue. And so, you know, what we're trying to do is get to where the data are being consumed. So in all its different forms, we're working with stakeholders to make sure that it's easy for them to consume good quality information, that they understand the context, and that people are just as interested in looking at the qualifiers of the data and, you know, what's excluded and what's not included. And so that they can actually walk away with what they think they're getting, not what they, you know, might be perceiving as right, but in fact, completely wrong. And lastly, we're also trying to help build some of the literacy and numeracy skills that are really important for people to do some critical thinking around these things. So we're doing our part. I don't think we're going to be exclusively the solution providers on this, but I think there's a there's a real desire and investment in trying to make sure that as a society that we're guided by good facts and good information.
I love data. I just think it's so powerful. And yet at the same time, it can be powerful for a source of good and challenge and not so good. And I love the point around, and I want to reiterate that and emphasize that a beautiful question you just articulated is how can we be better educated consumers of data? That's a really critical question. And also, are there ways in which that we can do that? You've started to talk about that. What are some other things or points of consideration for us?
I don't think I'm exaggerating it too much by saying that good data skills are now a basic skill set that is really required. And I know a lot of schools and institutions, educational institutions, are starting to put more emphasis on data management skills and, you know, how do you actually look at a table or chart and make sure that you can glean out of it what it's intended and what's not intended. So I'm glad to see that the schools, universities, even businesses and organizations that rely, as you know, on huge amounts of data. I don't know a single CEO that doesn't first thing in the morning look at what are some of the basic trends. I mean, GDP comes out, the CPI comes out, the consumer price index, the trade numbers come out, and you know, or what the markets are doing or what the dollar is doing. So I think we're very used to looking at those data points. And I think we just need to make sure that those skill sets are propagated. For us, it's, as I said, we need to sometimes be a little less technical because, you know, we can come across as a bit too scary. And so we're trying to do things like infographics, and we're trying to put out webinars, and we're trying to put out podcasts. We have an app, you know, that people can easily, you know, upload and use it, and you can put alerts. And so we're trying to increase the readability and the consumption. We're trying to be more available through webinars and ask me anything sessions and, you know, emails and so on. So people can see that we're reachable, that we're here as a service. I think we're partnering with so many organizations, from chambers of commerce to Federation of Canadian Municipalities to NGOs to you name it, with our other federal government colleagues, so that they can see that this is a team sport and we're here to help. So we're also playing a really important role in setting standards and playing that data stewardship role. And credit where it's due, I think some of the seminars, some of the podcasts that we put out, you know, have also been top leading. And I think the feedback that we've got is, yes, they're making a difference. And so the feedback that we get from our stakeholders and users is going this direction, which is great to see. So more to be done. Obviously, there are many, many consumers out there who are very busy. Not that they don't want to, but sometimes they would just take whatever Google might give them as the first choice and say, well, it's got to be true. As long as I cite it, it must be real. So our advice is be a little bit more discerning, do a little bit of research, and understand the limitations and strengths of what you're looking at, especially if you're going to make really, really important decisions that affect others or, you know, our economy or society. That kind of due diligence is really important.
People are so busy, and a lot of times that headline, read the headline and come to a conclusion without engaging in the critical thought. And I think, to your point, that I couldn't agree more. That's such a vital skill, especially now in a world with information overload, being able to discern the high, you know, as you said, the good data and separate it from the more questionable or just really misleading data, so we can make the most informed choices in our personal and professional lives. This pivots beautifully into my question around leadership, because there's just so much emphasis today on leadership. So when you reflect on leadership and the qualities for effective leadership, what do you think are front and center and what we, for both current leaders and aspiring leaders, to really build?
Well, it's an excellent question. Leadership is the same, except that everything around it has changed. So there's a little cartoon, you know, where two young fish sort of swim by and an older one swims in the other direction. And the older one says to the other two, how's the water? And they look at him funny. And as they kind of pass each other, the one young fish says to the other, what's water? The point is that leadership it works in a context. And, you know, the same thing that applies in a moment of crisis, slow or fast, because there are slow moving crises, as we've just discussed earlier, you know, that leadership has to take that into account. I mean, if, you know, a whole population has just gone through a very stressful situation, there's been tragedies, there's been upheaval in lives and well-being and so on. But if as a leader, we don't understand that and we just keep going with what we've done previously, you can almost see the disaster kind of coming, right? So I think today's leader is not the same leader as 10 years ago or 5 years ago or 20 years ago. That leader today, she has to be far more aware of what are the data showing? Like, what's the fact? What's the reality? Has to be able to show that context and how it's evolving within the organization and that organization, you know, within today's economy or society with some of the challenges that we talked about up early on. Your business and how it operates in an international context is going to be very different in terms of leadership style than something that's local and relying on a neighborhood clientele, for example. So I think understanding the context, understanding your people, knowing, having good facts and data that tell you what's going on. In the old, it was like wisdom and, you know, I did this and that'll work. Well, there are some really, really smart, sharp people who are more than happy to tell you, yeah, but here's the data. You know, so one needs to have a little bit of humility and defer to evidence rather than gut feeling and so on. And you have to kind of be ready to be challenged and be ready to be proven wrong. And it's okay. And a good leader today has or she have no problems in saying, you know what, I didn't get that right. What do I learn from it? And how do I, you know, engage and work? Leadership, of course, is all about people, right? It's kind of a prerequisite, I suppose. Leading people requires today a far greater amount of empathy and understanding of people's motivations and their fears. I mean, like I said, if society's gone through a huge stressful experience, we see that they either tell us about mental health and so on. But if we as leaders don't think that the people that work with us, our colleagues, aren't part of society and that they're somehow, you know, as soon as they walk in through the door at 8 o'clock in the morning or whatever, that there's something else. Well, that's a real problem and a mistake. So I think understanding that our colleagues, ourselves, we are part of that society and going through that same change and where things now intersect, whereas previously people could make that distinction, just needs us to be a bit more sophisticated and look at the complexity of what leadership looks like to me. And yet, even with that complexity, how do we simplify things and go to the basic values and trust? And those things don't change. And that empathy and listening, I think those are the skill sets of a leader. Leadership is inherently more difficult today. It's not for everybody. And frankly, I think a healthy dose of humility, but equally that ability to have a compelling vision, to influence and inspire people, be that listener and still making sure that we can simplify things and move forward and simplify in the sense of being really crisp about where is it that, you know, the organization wants and needs to go and then aligning it with the employees and their desires. When those two things intersect and you've got a healthy Venn diagram, it's a golden opportunity for organizations.
Well, and I received so many awesome answer. Love this. Great insights. Thank you, Anil, coming in. So I want to pass that along. And I had so many great points that you made. I love your observation about leadership happens in a context. It works in a context. And I'm with you very much as well in terms of just what has happened over the past several years, that it's amplified things that were pre-COVID. There are all these things coming to bear that now when COVID happened, it just mental health and all kinds of other aspects that just continue to come to the surface. And fundamentally, the human side of leadership, it just is getting increasingly important, yet it's always been there. It's always an essential part of it. And I love your emphasis on understanding of context and people, and in particular on the empathy piece, understanding someone else's space, what's important to them, what they value, sharing what I value, and then also having the humility to just say, I didn't get this. I was off on that. Once again, love the point on data and referencing data. I mean, some of the most compelling conversations I've been a part of is that, so how do we use this moment in time to experiment, gather data and make informed decisions rather than go, well, I think this or I think why? Let's use data.
Organizations are sitting on a wealth of data. I think a lot of organizations are quite happy to use that data to increase their market share, to make the right decisions on when to invest in capital or more labor or whatever it is. But we tend to somehow downplay the data that we have that allows us to be better leaders within our organizations. Now, that does not say that we shouldn't be taking privacy and confidentiality and, you know, residual disclosure issues or how, but there is tremendous wealth in the data itself about ourselves. And in fact, I always find that when we can harness that in responsible ways, it will actually help propel the business or our objectives as, you know, whether public organizations or private forward. And I think it's underutilized. And so in my organization, I try to use our corporate leaders, not just as service, internal service providers or gatekeepers or whatever, but they're truly enablers that align us to move us as a unit forward in achieving our vision. So there is a lot of information there. So having the data management skills, as I said, with the privacy protection techniques and so on built in, has been a phenomenal investment for us anyway.
Well, and again, I just love that approach in terms of looking at, so what are the data sharing and showing us about our leadership and how we're showing up? And then we can make informed choices around that and recognizing the impacts. And then also having the humility to look at those data as well. So my next question, Anil, this is your life. I'd love for you to describe, so who are you as a leader? What's your leadership philosophy? Who's authentic, Anil?
First of all, you know, leadership shifts and changes, as I mentioned. You know, we all learn over time. You know, what I thought in my 20s and 30s as leadership isn't the same that I see today. So the context is different, technology is different, the data availability is different, the workforce is different. So me as an authentic leader is one that is not afraid to change my mind and open to saying, you know what, that worked there, but it will work here. It's being vulnerable and open to feedback. So I believe in asking my team on a regular basis, like, what can I do differently? Like, you know what? I don't think that conversation went very well. I don't think I was very clear about what it is that, you know, I meant to say. I don't think I listened to you well enough. And the authentic Anil is always kind of learning, and not afraid to admit, you know, my failures. And I tell them, like, you need to help me as a leader so I can help the organization and everybody else. So I'm not afraid to show frailty. I'm not afraid to show weaknesses. I'm not afraid to show, because I feel when I do that, I'm showing that I am connecting at a human level with my colleagues, and we're in this thing together. I may have a different role, but the objectives are not that different. And the trust that we have within each other is shared, and that I do make mistakes as well. But boy, I'm the first one to admit it and learn from it. So that's it. I don't know what else, like, what else? Who else could one be? Because it, you know, I tried to be fake. I think they probably figured it out in about 30 seconds. Like, well, wait a second, that's just a put on. Because you can't sustain something that is not authentic for too long. Having said that, in moments of crisis, you will see a very different Anil. Like, it's clear, this is where we need to go. This is who's going to do what. This is the reporting structure. Here are the success criteria and the KPI or the key performance indicators that we're going to manage and measure to go ahead. So there is that leadership style when it needs it. Okay, that's not every single day. And you'd hope that you're not, well, I suppose somebody could be in those kinds of jobs, but that's generally not the sort of the default style. I think the default style is a bit more on that partnership, collaboration, and all those attributes that I just talked about. So the last thing I would say is that there are some individuals with whom you just have to be really straight up front and say, that's just not going to work here. And you're going to have to make a tough choice. And so leadership and authenticity also take courage, because I think equally people see the vulnerability, but they also see inconsistency. Leadership is also what you tolerate, and people see what you tolerate and they call you out on it. So diversity, inclusion, accessibility, authenticity, you know, with generous amounts of listening and learning and humility, I think that's kind of where we are as leaders.
And I love the point about linking it back to the authenticity as well, that you hear it more and more in conversation about the importance of being authentic. And as soon as there's inconsistency now, right away, and you talked about trust, and again, awesome that you made that link reference earlier, because as soon as those inconsistencies start, then now it's like, oh, what's going on here? Who is this person? How does this all connect? And this is critical. And I really appreciate you shining a light on courage, because having difficult conversations, that's a, It's a part of life. It's even more of a part of leadership, right? That's the mantle of responsibility. And it's important for us to be able to show up very, very authentically in those conversations, not shy away. We must have that courage, especially in our environment. Got another question, and this is from Tom, who said, really love the idea of asking for feedback. Often I'm afraid of, like, what if I don't like the answer or I disagree? Like, any advice on that front?
Yeah, look, what's the alternative, right? I mean, if you don't ask, you know, I think most people say, well, he doesn't care. He doesn't care what I think or whatever. No, doesn't mean that you have to agree with everything. It is a perspective. It's another data point that you have to be able to then put into your repertoire to say, okay, well, you know what? Maybe I can do a little better in terms of being clearer with my message or the resonating with people. So maybe that strategy didn't work. So even though that is exactly what I'm saying, people aren't getting it. Or I'm saying this, but this is what people are listening. And so denying yourself that data point doesn't really help you be a more effective leader. So you're better off to ask and get feedback that you might just not agree with. That's okay. You at least have a choice to make at that point. But not knowing is, I think, more fatal than receiving something that you may not agree with, right?
I love, again, what's great. And thank you. Got a bunch of thank yous on that answer. And it is about choice, because now we have data. Feedback is data that now we can choose to either ignore or act on. And now we're empowering ourselves around it. And I think the framing that you just used, Anil, on that is, hey, like, let's ask. It's out there. So it's better for us to know whatever that is and tackle it and be aware, put that into our awareness.
You know, the more complicated our organizations are, the more diverse they are, the more spread out they are, the more hierarchical they may be, there just happens to be these permafrost zones that kind of appear in organizations. And I think it's better to find out and then deal with it, because if I'm sitting in my office and pulling levers all day, I would hate to think at the end of the day that they weren't connected to anything. So now, Chris, as leaders, we're generally working through governance systems, we're working through layers and so on. It's important and it's critical to build feedback mechanisms so that you can see whether the intention and the result are connected, or the message and the noise and the signals are not connected, or whether the culture is supportive or not. So I think that feedback loop is really, really critical. Now, it has to be authentic. We have to be willing to listen to what people are saying and not dismiss it. And as I said, a healthy dose of humility, where you suspend judgment and there's that appreciative inquiry on what we're hearing, and then having that open discussion, say, well, how do you mean? What could I do better to get the message out? I think those are all areas that I think I can certainly do better in. And I'm always trying to do a better job.
Well, and thank you. And really appreciate that reference to appreciative inquiry, asking questions, you know, what's right about this feedback, as opposed to looking to dismiss it outright. Can you give me some examples? Like, how else could I approach? All based in curiosity. And I think it just deepens the relationship. And again, coming back to a core element you touched on before, trust. Because it demonstrates a genuine curiosity on our side, and we can explore that together. I've got another question. Questions are fire coming on in, and I'm not surprised. So Anne wants to explore a little deeper on the inconsistency. So any advice in terms of how do you address inconsistencies in someone when you see it, when they're clearly offside and they're flipping back and forth? Any advice around how you raise that, how you address that?
So if I understand the question right, this is somebody who is saying one thing but acting another way. People translate things in certain ways. Like, you know, we can have the same word but have a very different kind of perspective just because of our lived experience, right? And you know, the examples of looking at the mountain and the lake and just having a very different kind of experience from it. So that happens. So I think we just have to, first of all, just acknowledge that, right? You know, there's a lot of connotations around language and connotations around things. So going to like something a bit more objective, like the data, the results, the, you know, something that's tangible to kind of break the ties in the sense between what may appear as inconsistent, but frankly, it's an interpretation that that might not align with the vocabulary that we use. So first is not jumping to the conclusion, wow, this person just kind of just wants to appear or whatever. And so that's the first. But if you do see somebody who's just kind of, you know, saying one thing, but doing another thing, it's entirely okay to have a chat with them and say, like, I don't understand how, if we have these values and if we have these objectives and if we have this vision, how this action is supporting that, because I don't understand. Help me understand. And listen, I mean, you know, they may just have a different strategy to achieve, you know, the same objective, but just may appear to be inconsistent, or they may have adapted it to their particular context that we may not, at, you know, whatever level we might be at, be aware of that level. Because the organizations have production units, strategic units, you know, policy setting, regulatory, whatever it might be. And so sometimes those messages have to be adapted in a way that works in that context. And that's okay, as long as you know that it's ultimately aligned to the objective of the vision. So I don't want to come across as, you know, I'm just going to give everybody the benefit of the doubt. Like sometimes if they truly are misaligned, you may have to sit down and say, look, I understand, but that's going the wrong way. Like, we're not going to give everybody an extra 10 days of vacation. You know what I mean? Like, it's just not going to happen. You know what I mean? So sometimes you have to call on it and say, that's not on, right? And so, yeah. So sometimes that courage and being clear and being very directive about the direction that you want is okay to get rid of that inconsistency that you might have in the organization.
Mm-hmm. Well, and again, I really appreciate the reference to the labels, because I see it so often in the coaching work that I do, where people are using the same behavior, different labels. And so now, even though it sounds like, and it's wild, all of the assumptions that can be built into that. And I really appreciate your perspective on this, Anil, about, well, ask a question, be curious, rather than jump to a conclusion. Oh, well, you are X. Help me understand, Craig. I heard you say this, and then I observed that. Can you thread that needle for me? And it's curiosity, and you're not judging anyone around it. And perhaps in their mind, again, they see the situation a little differently, or they may be inconsistent. And now that's an important point for us to discuss. So I really appreciate that point, again, for curiosity.
Yeah, you know, like I've had the fortune of going into new organizations and setting a new vision and kind of taking it in a different direction. And yes, there are some people who are very adverse to change and want to simply relabel things so that they align with the direction that you want. And so one has to be a little bit critical in that. And so you want to have that openness in it. But also I would say, in addition to everything that we've just talked about, build some objective metrics that tell you, you know, whether the action and the direction and the you know, what you want as change behavior and outcomes are in fact happening. So if it's a line of business that you don't want to be in, and people are just kind of saying, well, there can be objective measures on revenue or otherwise that can tell you very clearly that shift didn't occur, or the reverse, you want it in a particular direction. And if you're not seeing the sales, or you're not seeing that market penetration, or you're not seeing, you know, usage of data or a policy or a regulatory conformant, well, then the data will start to tell you. And I think making that available to the person that's talking gets them to go, yeah, I guess it's not really. So I think making it self-evident is I think really, really important. And, you know, hopefully turning somebody around as really a proponent rather than an opponent.
Yeah, well, thank you. No, great insights. And I have another question. Tara was wondering about return to office. And so this, as we've turned the corner around the pandemic, or we continue to turn that corner again, back to labeling, how can organizations, you know, do this effectively, have those operate with courage and empathy, using two of your words from before? So what are your thoughts on that?
It's been far more difficult than I thought it would be, frankly. I'm just kind of speak about my own kind of direction and vision and experience. So long before the pandemic, for my organization, I had this kind of vision of a hybrid type of an approach. I call it hybrid at the time, but the intent was that from time to time, you can work from an alternate location, and that the data can actually flow with people in a secure way. And so that mobility, if you like, of the data and the expertise could create greater value. So it'd create greater mobility of people to move and broaden their skill sets. We could actually start to bring different data sets together to create new insights, and those flexibilities would be there. And frankly, in a country like Canada, when you have snowstorms, we actually triangulated data. Like when we have 10 centimeters of snow, what does the sick leave look like? When we have 20 centimeters of snow, what does the sick leave look like? That comes back to that point about, you know, all the data that we don't necessarily always triangulate. So what we found was there was a significant increase in leave, especially most women, when the number of centimeters of snow was high. So we said, well, clearly in some cases, it's the moms staying home with the kids because the school buses aren't running. And so they have to take leave. And so we thought, okay, well, look, there's a business case here for the technologies to be able to allow people to securely work from alternate locations. And so we were already having that kind of success before the pandemic. And the idea was the pandemic obviously didn't give us a choice and said, boom, you know what? We have no choice. We're all going to work virtually for periods of time. Although many people in very, very important services came to the office and worked in secure ways throughout the whole pandemic. So I don't want to in any way negate that or take away from the work that happened. And many organizations had that, right? So critical services where people did that. Now the question is, how do you, like, what is that new norm? How do you establish it? Because people did that and did a great job, I would say. And so many of them look at this as punitive in a sense. Right? Why are you making me buy new clothes, buy parking, you know, lunches, this, that, and the other? And they got used to like home care, elder care, daycare. And so it's hard. It's hard for them to say, but as an organization, we know that there is a cost. You know, when people aren't coming together to innovate, share ideas, mentor new people, well, then we're not seeing that same kind of productivity and that same culture and that spirit of kind of, you know, making things incrementally better. And so finding that right norm, depending upon the business that you're in, depending upon the culture, depending upon the demographics and of you, who you have, just requires a little bit more thought. And, you know, not everybody likes it. Not everybody likes everything. But to your team, you have to at least be consistent and figure out what makes sense. And to, you know, new people who are coming in, you have to figure out what kind of mentoring and coaching you can give them, what kind of innovation. So it's got to be driven with purpose. It's got to have a little bit of flexibility. And I think at the end of the day, you can't kind of sacrifice the norms and values of an organization as you move to a hybrid kind of future. So it's not easy. It is happening. And I think a lot of our data are showing that people who are consistently coming in are now happier than those that very infrequently or don't come in at all to meet their colleagues. And it can't just be, we got together for lunch. I don't think that's quite working. I think they actually have to roll up their sleeves and actually work to make things better, create new products and innovative types of solutions. And that's what's giving people more satisfaction with what the work looks like.
Bill, and thank you. And again, comments coming in around, really appreciate that. The focus on purpose, flexibility, and values, anchors, if you will, in terms of, okay, and really appreciate the point, because part of conversations that I've been in around, okay, it's before pre-pandemic, for the most part, there was almost like this level playing field. Now everyone's like, okay, so what does this look like for us, right? And being thoughtful around it. And I really think starting with why, that purpose statement, recognizing the flexibility to take into account, all right, what's happening in our context and anchoring it in values. And really appreciate the point around, it's fascinating here, the data that you have, Anil, around people being happier who come in more because have Dr. Robert Waldinger come in. And there was one of the recent episodes I released, and that was one of his, without weighing it, it was like, it's all about relationships. Like the relationships we have drive happiness, meaning, satisfaction with life. And so that was a question about, so what's going to be the consequence? We don't have time for interaction above and beyond, as you said, lunch and everything else, like that meaningful connection. So love that point. I have another question that's come in as well from Timothy, and he was wondering, like, it seems like people are really burnt out, or you read a lot about just people feeling stretched, overburdened, like a lot bad news coming at us. What are your thoughts around keeping people motivated when there's been such a prolonged period of challenge?
Yeah, look, even say whatever the $64 million questionnaire or whatever it is, if anybody finds the elixir of that, please share it. So as I was saying right at the beginning of the session, right, we live in a context. We've just come through, you know, hopefully come through and to hopefully once in a whatever 50, 60 years, kind of a crisis of that nature. It has been anything but ordinary, and it has been everything that a disruption would look like. And it's been, you know, I think, was it the poly crisis is one of the terms that's being used. So it's like one crisis after the other, after the other. So, you know, there was the health, which then got into an economic and affordability. And of course, it doesn't affect everybody the same way. Our data show that if you're youth, you're hurting a lot more. If you're part of a racialized group, you're hurting a lot more. If you're a person with a disability, you're really hurting. An Indigenous person is. So the impacts are not the same on everybody. Some have actually done better. I mean, we also talked about triple protected jobs. You know, people who were in jobs that could be done remotely that had good job security and tenure, and actually, because they weren't spending as much, actually made off well better financially as well. So you can't kind of paint it with the same brush. And yet there are people that organizations, including mine, relied on a heck of a lot more because, well, guess what? They were in that pivotal role. They had the knowledge, they had the skill sets, and we needed it in our desire to serve Canadians during that period. We just over relied on them. And in some cases, that workload distribution was not equal and it was disproportionate. And so as leaders, we have to recognize that, you know, we're not robots. We are humans. We do need that recharge, and then we need to find innovative ways to make sure. Now, I also am a bit careful and cautious that if that narrative gets out there that everybody, you know, is overworked and stressed and whatever, I mean, even people who aren't, oh, there must be something wrong with me if I'm not. I think we need to be careful about that. So you need a really honest, open conversation. Organizations usually have a norm, a bar, a set kind of, you know, a set of expectations. And so, you know, there has to be some objective measures which show, you know, yes, we truly did. And this one, well, no, hang on, that's a bit of a myth. We need to address it. So it's a bit more complicated. And that's why I said it's a $64 million question, because it's not one formula that's going to work. And if one gets it wrong, one could actually have the opposite effect than that is desired. So you have to rely on some objective metrics, and then you have to apply some of the metrics or the success indicators, and then be able to track them over time to see whether the kind of initiatives that are being put in place, or you put in place, are having the desired result. So you want the performance of those that maybe wasn't that stellar or great. You want to invest in their skill set so that it can come up to the level that you want. And for those that maybe were overburdened, and how do you provide opportunities for them to have that kind of balance, which makes sense. So you might be pulling and pushing in an organization at the same time. It might be hierarchical. It might be in for certain sets of groups and so on. This is where empathy, generous amounts of listening, being able to discern, you know, what is fact or not with good evidence, and then building in metrics that demonstrate that you're having the desired result that you want in the direction that you want, obviously aligned to the business of the organization.
And that focus on open and honest conversations. And it harkens me back to the beginning again. It's amazing how some threads continue along with you, right? Where you talked about context and recognizing. So rather than having a blanket statement of, okay, well, what's the context? What's operating here? And what are some of the important, and what are some of the potential consequences or unintended consequences that were through an adoption of a particular perspective? And also really appreciated that emphasis on listening and empathy, and then also about us not being robots, which perfectly sets me up for my last. We're almost out of time. This is something that I was curious about your take on, because AI is everywhere, and ChatGPT, and so it's difficult to go anywhere these days without it. And I had a few questions in the hopper here, and that was going to be one of mine. So in terms of where you are, Anil, what are your thoughts around artificial intelligence, how it's going to impact us as a society, as employers, as Canadians? as citizens of the world. Love to get your take on that.
Yeah, look, I mean, somewhere between the hype and the genuine applicability, I think, is the truth. And so, you know, there's some harmless kinds of utility of AI. Who knows? Maybe you even went to ChatGPT and said, "What should I ask the chief statistician?" So, I mean, so you know what I mean? I think a lot of people, including me, will go to ChatGPT and just kind of, you know, ask them innocent questions and things like that. So I think the ability for, you know, large language models to be able to give us human consumptive language and data and facts and so on, I think is a wonderful kind of way forward. I think it's when we start to apply it in ways that now start to impact decisions, safety, policy decisions, regulatory kind of work, or business kind of, that's when it becomes very real. And I think that's where we need the kind of checks and balances at all levels. We need it at a moral and ethical level. We need it at the regulatory and legal level. And we need it at the consumption level. And as you know, I mean, these models are based on data, right? That's what they do. They take data and they kind of comb, store their acts accessible, and then try and put it in a language that, you know, resonates with us as human beings. So it is very well researched and is actually quite, you know, amazing. And some of it is just, as they say, hallucination. So it is the engine kind of doubling down on something that it thinks is, it's right or what we want to hear, but it's really not based on any facts. And then there's a malicious kind of, you know, you've seen the images of famous people with voices and doing things and so on. So there's a malicious component to it as well. I would say a lot of disruptive technologies start that way, right? And then I think they settle down. We build in the kind of guidance, we build in the governance, we build in the frameworks for ethical and moral applications of them. This doesn't mean that there won't be a rogue state or rogue use or rogue whatever, but I think we have to find that balance of caution and utility. It's like the car, right? It has both accelerator and the brakes, and we need to use them in the right context and the right proportions. So I know there's a lot of work going on, you know, my own organization internationally as well. And I think we're staying on top of both the positives as well as some of the negatives. And I think like anything else, this will evolve. The pace of this is amazing when you look at how quickly it's taken on. And so I think it is something to be a little bit cautious about and a little bit skeptical about, but I would say we can't be paralyzed by it like a deer in the headlights as well. I think we need to learn about it. We need to understand how to contend with it, need to cautiously and carefully experiment with it, but know that the underlying data are really, really important. Those biases, you know, incorrect data, wrong sources will only get exacerbated as these technologies take on. So that critical thinking that we talked about up front, I think is going to be just as important. So being numerate and literate, I think, is key to these things.
Well, and thank you. And such, again, phenomenal answer. Thank you. Really insightful, lots to think about coming in the comment section. And for me, and this is why I was so excited for you to come back. And again, thank you. The hour's just flown by. I can't believe it's, you know, we're 3 minutes away. And what I really love about how you started the answer to the question was moral and ethical implications. That is such, you know, I heard it described as, you know, being good parents, if you will, around AI. And I think that's such a powerful and such an important thing for all of us to reflect on. And also, as you talked about the data, right? That's going to be, we're all data points that also are part of that process. So thank you. That's just given me so much to think about. I feel so privileged that you've taken the time out of your extraordinarily hectic schedule to share your wisdom, your experience, your insight, your passion with us. Any final words before we say goodbye today?
Well, all I have is gratitude for you and the work that you're doing to develop leaders like myself and so many more to push our country forward. And so I just want to say thank you for all that you do. Congratulations on the book and the podcast. It should be the number one and stay at that number one spot for a long, long time. So Craig, thank you for your invitation and your friendship. And I really, really do admire what you're doing. And I just want to say thank you to everybody that posed the questions and we're interested in what's going on in Canada today. So thank you, Craig.
Well, you're welcome. Feelings are mutual. And again, seeing the fabulous questions. Oh, I love being referred to this, right? It's like a fly on the wall, this amazing conversation and touching on things that are so important to each of us personally and professionally. And then talk about how we can be at our best so that we can show up the way that we want for others. And I really do. It's something that, again, for me, it's on multiple layers. How can we be better educated data consumers? And there's data all around us, and how can we best absorb and act on them? So thank you for all the amazing work that you do and your passion around ensuring that we have the best data possible for us to go through. So thank you, everybody. This was amazing. Can't wait to see you on a future episode. Bye for now.
Thank you so much for joining me here today on Do Good to Lead Well. If you enjoyed today's podcast, please subscribe and leave a review. If you'd like to continue the conversation, you can follow me on Twitter at Craig Dowden or reach out via LinkedIn or email info@craigdowden.com. I look forward to meeting you here next week for another transformational episode.